Where shall we start? I'll start here. A question was raised during the little break we had. Well, see if I can put this. So, Saul, what's the point of Saul? Why did Saul come along? All right, you've all heard this theme before from the Old Testament. Tell me about that theme. Where do you find that? I know you've heard this a lot. Pardon? Garden. Tell me about it. Tree of knowledge of good and evil. He was just supposed to sit at that nice tree of life and gobble that fruit down for however long God told him to. And at some point, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil would be his, which is a tree essentially of rule. See, really, we can put it this way. Here's the tree of life. Isn't that nice? It's got all this fruit on it and everything. It's a really pretty tree. And here's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's got this mean snake that's over here. And he's, okay, so he's hanging from that tree. All right. Now, this is a tree, the tree of life. This is not the totality of it, but let me make a suggestion here. This tree represents many things. Represents joy. Represents gratitude. What do we have that we don't give thanks for? That we don't owe thanks for? The only payment we can possibly give back to God is thanksgiving. There's nothing else we can repay. And it's an infinite, we keep giving. It goes into this infinitely. We give thanks to God for all. I didn't create myself. I didn't create anything. This is also a tree of play. See, when children play, play is life without consequence. And it's very, very important for children to play. Because when you play, you're learning how to live life. But you first have to learn to live life. It's fun. It's practice. You figure out how to do it. And there are no consequences. So you can make mistakes. So little girls play mommy, and there's no blood. Little boys play cowboys and Indians, cops and robbers, whatever, soldier. And they go bang, bang, seeing little boys can make guns out of anything. I remember, I come from Boulder. I don't come from Nashville. A friend of mine said he was really enamored with the idea that nobody should give guns to their little boys. What evil toys. Says, then what I found out when I had little boys is they turn anything into guns. Everything into guns. All right, so little boys play cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians or soldier. Bang, bang, you're dead and you fall down. But nobody dies. So you play, and it's really important to play. And then at a certain point, God says, okay, you're growing up now. This is a tree. See, now I think when you take communion, that this is what corresponds to the bread, and this is what corresponds to the wine. Now, what does wine represent?
Maturity.
Yeah, but literally, what does it represent?
Blood.
See, blood's serious. Blood is serious. The tree of play, there's no blood. Now, life gets serious, and now you're going to rule things, but you don't want to do that too soon. Or it's deadly. You don't hand the world over to 10-year-olds. So if you woke up tomorrow morning and it said President Obama has now assigned Johnny Smith from Minneapolis, who's 10 years old, to the Supreme Court, we would probably be in even more trouble than we're in now. Right? Because that's for mature people. All right, so you all know this. This is all exactly the same thing is true with the monarchy. The monarchy was a great blessing. But the children of Israel said, we have to have a monarch now. If they had only waited, they could have avoided all this pain, and God would have raised up in his own way, by his own power, without all that conflict and all that bloodshed and all that civil war that went on with this transition, he would have given the monarchy to David probably in the first place. If it hadn't been David, it would have been somebody like David, would have been a good king. And it would have not involved all this terrible chaos and so on. So that's the point. So let's look at the life of David. The refrain that we have in the book of Judges is over and over, and the book of Judges closes with this refrain. And in those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes, referring to worship. So, book of Samuel opens, and what we find is that, and by the way, if any of you have read it, I have stolen a good deal of this straight from Peter Lighthart, so some of this will sound just like what his book is about, which he's written a little book about this, terrific little book. Not all of it, but some of what I'm going to say. So the book of Judges, book of 1 Samuel opens, and we read about Samuel, who's one of these miracle children from a barren woman. He's the last judge, and he's raised in the temple, and there's a corrupt priest, and his sons are corrupt priests, and they're stealing from the altar in all kinds of ways. And God is about to make a great transition. This is when the Philistines come in, and they steal away the Ark of the Covenant. And it goes down into the land of the Philistines, and they put it in the, they put the Ark of the Covenant in the temple of their god, Dagon. And what happens in the temple of Dagon? They wake up in the morning, and what happened? That's right, Dagon has fallen down on his face before the ark. Happens twice. It's a very funny story, showing that the gods of the Philistines have got to submit to Yahweh, who is the great God, the true God. And then they all break out, and this plague breaks out, and they have these terrible lumps that break out in their bodies, and so they decide they're sending this thing back to Israel. It goes back to Israel, and that's kind of a funny story too, but it gets parked in somebody's front yard for a really long time. It's actually there through the whole kingship of Saul. And it's interesting that Saul never consults. We have no record of him consulting before the Ark of the Covenant. He never asks God, never asks the priest. We don't have any record of that. In fact, who does he finally consult before? A witch. Witch of Endor. That's right. And this is the end of Saul. So, we get to this point, and earlier than this, there has been... Saul's life has really collapsed and fallen apart. And I remember... there are two things that happen in the young David's life very early that foreshadow everything about his whole kingship. The very first one that happens is Saul, by this time, the Holy Spirit has departed from him. And God doesn't talk to him. And God doesn't say anything to him through the prophets or anyone else. And instead, he is now harassed by what? Demons. He's demon-possessed. And what they find, and we're not given very much information about this, but this kid seems to have some kind of amazing gifts. And he comes in and he plays his lute for Saul. And the demons have to depart. They have to go away. Now, that means that David is a what?
He's a spiritual warrior.
Yeah, there's a simple word we often use.
Exorcist.
He's an exorcist. Now, I remember years ago, and I said this for years, and I was up here teaching this one day in Boulder, and suddenly it occurred to me, why do I keep saying that? I remember hearing R.C. Sproul say, years and years ago, I was at Ligonier, many years ago, and this is typical, this is a common reference. Every miracle in the Old Testament is replicated in the New, except for one. Do you know which one it is? And R.C. says, the miracle of casting out demons. And I repeated that for years until it finally occurred to me. One day I'm teaching this. I said, that's not true. David's an exorcist. David cast out, every miracle in the Old Testament is actually, in the New Testament, is replicated in the Old, including this one. David is an exorcist. And he casts out, the demons have to leave. So later on, now here's the story. This is after what Samuel does, which we already talked about last hour. Saul has been rejected by God, and he says, I'm going to raise up a new king, go to the house of Jesse, and he goes to the house of Jesse, and he sees the eldest, and he says, surely this is the one. He's so tall and handsome, looks like a real warrior. God says, nope, not him. Goes to the next one, the seventh one, nope, not him. Keeps going down. Finally gets to the very last son, and God says, every one of them says, nope. And Samuel is really confused. He says, well, you know, this is every son in the house, God. And he says, is there anyone else? And Jesse says, well, yeah, there's the kid. You know, he's out in the back 40 herding the sheep out there. But, you know, he's just a kid. Bring him in. And God says, that's him. Youngest, eighth son. Very youngest. So God overturns primogeniture. Now, this is one of the really cool things I learned from Jim Jordan years ago. Why is primogeniture, overturning of primogeniture, such a big deal in the Old Testament? Because who is, in fact, the firstborn in the Bible? So that makes Jesus, the Christ, is actually the younger brother. That's the meaning of the constant overturning of primogeniture. Now, I'm not entirely sure what to do. Maybe somebody here has a cool answer for this. I'm not entirely sure what to do with the fact that eventually Judah is the one who really does have the rights of the firstborn. So I guess Jesus is both the youngest and the eldest all at the same time, because I guess that's the answer. He's both the eternal Son of God, but humanly speaking, he's the younger brother. So he's both. Yeah, Jesus does all those cool things no one else can do. All right, so the youngest son, David, is anointed by Samuel and pours the oil on him, and then this is a big secret. Nobody else knows about this. And then the next thing you know, there's David in the palace, playing this lute for Saul. And then the next thing you know, his brothers, his other seven big brothers, have gone off to war, and David's too young for the military draft. And his father says, finally one day, says, David, I want you to go out and check on your big brothers and see how they are and take some supplies out to them. So he sends them out, and he gets out there, and it's out there, and he finds out that there's this giant who comes out every day, and he says, fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Israelite. He's going to grind his bones and make his bread with them. Comes out every day and challenges as the great champion. And the Israelites, he's 9 feet tall. You know, he uses a wagon axle for a spear. This guy's enormous. Nobody's going to go do war with him because it's winner takes all. Whoever wins this battle is the slaves of the other people. Comes out 40 days and 40 nights, challenges the Israelites. Nobody will take it. And David shows up, and he's appalled. He's shocked. He says, I can't believe it. This man comes out and defies the armies of the living God. And he goes, see, now here's the interesting thing about this story. What we know is that Saul, the king, consents to let this kid go out and do war with this great 9-foot-tall champion. Why would he do that? I mean, David must be 15 or 16. Well, the only answer, it's not just this happened out of the blue. This is the kid who can drive out demons. This is some amazing kid. And David says, well, I've done things like, I mean, you think he's big? I've killed bears. You know how big bears are? I've killed lions. I know how to do this. He's not going to do it, of course, with Saul's armor. He does it with his own sling. Goes out, gets the 5 smooth stones, whoosh, kills Goliath. All right, now these two things foreshadow everything in David's life. Killing of Goliath foreshadows the fact that he is a great military king. The fact that he is able to cast out demons foreshadows what he's ultimately being called to do in his life, and that is reestablish worship. Those two things foreshadow everything, tell you everything you need to know about David. Now, what Joshua said when they first went into the land is you've got to wipe them out. And the whole story of the book of Judges is the fact that they didn't do that, so they were ensnared over and over and over and over. Now, hundreds of years later, what happens, and this is what, of course, happens when Saul is still a king, this kid, after he kills Goliath, starts to be the leader of the armies, and Saul becomes jealous because this kid's a military genius, and the troops follow him. It's like, you know, it's like that amazing story, sort of like that, I mean, about Joan of Arc. I mean, Joan of Arc is one of those great mysteries in the middle of, like, this thumb. How do you explain her? This maiden who comes out of Orleans and leads the armies. And David's kind of like that, except he's a man. You know, So, of course, Saul is jealous because the people say Saul has killed his thousands, but David's killed his tens of thousands. So he becomes the enemy of Saul, and there's this long civil war that ensues, which eventually, of course, Saul kills himself, and eventually David becomes the leader of all of Israel, Hebron, and becomes the king. Now, in the midst of, after all of this has happened, what we find, and this is what I take from Peter, this wonderful little monograph he's written. What we find is that David says, you know, the Ark of the Covenant has been parked over there in that Gentile's front yard for 40 years. I think it's a long time. It's a really a long time it's over there. He says, we really need to go get it. So he sends a crew out to go get it, and they put it on an ox cart. And you all know the story. Starts to fall over. And what's the man's name who puts his hand up? What is it?
Uzzah
puts his hand up to catch it. Seems like a nice thing to do. And God kills him. And David is really mad at God about this. And so he goes back and he studies the Bible and studies the law and finds out, no, you only move this thing on poles because God only flies. He doesn't go on ox carts. So they have to lift it up on poles, and they finally move it. And it gets moved to somebody else's front yard. It's also, interestingly, a Gentile. And then it's parked there for really a long time. And what's interesting, does anybody know what the name of the mountain was where finally the temple was built, that Solomon built?
Yes.
What's the name of it? Moriah. Moriah, you know, I don't know exactly the geography of Jerusalem, but here's Moriah over here. Where was the Ark of the Covenant parked at this point?
David's city to the south.
And what's the name of the hill?
Zion.
Now, I don't know about you, but I've never heard of a Mount Moriah Baptist Church. But there must be 10 million Mount Zion Baptist churches, right? I mean, Mount Zion everywhere, all the time. You don't really, you do hear some about Moriah, but what you hear about constantly in the Bible is Mount Zion. And if you go to the book of Amos, you'll find that the prophecy that's given, that's quoted in the book of Acts, is that God is going to restore in the church, what the church is going to be is the restoration of Mount Zion. Now, why is that? This is very interesting. David takes this thing and he parks it up here somewhere, and then he puts the tabernacle around it. And let me ask you a question. When the tabernacle was over here at Shiloh, here you've got the tabernacle, and here's the Holy of Holies here, and here's the Ark of the Covenant parked in here. Who has access to the Ark of the Covenant?
High priest.
For how often?
Once a year.
That's on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. He goes in there. And you don't dare go in there because you will die. Now, when the temple is, Solomon builds this big, glitzy, shiny new temple up here, and they bring the Ark of the Covenant up here, and they put it in the Holy of Holies somewhere here. Who has access to that ark? The high priest. How often? Once a year on Yom Kippur, and nobody else dares go in there because you will die. Now, here's what's really interesting. David takes this thing and he parks it on top of Mount Zion. And who has access to the Ark of the Covenant for I don't know how long this was, 20, 30, 40 years? Who has access to the Ark of the Covenant? Everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone. I mean, it's just shocking. It's amazing. And when David talks about, he talks about going and sitting in the presence of God, apparently what he's talking about is he's going up here on Mount Zion, he's getting a chair and he's sitting down in front of the ark and having a talk with God. Now you see what happens. You got the second temple, you got the Holy of Holies in there, and Jesus dies on the cross, and there all this weather stuff happens. You know, it gets dark in it for 3 hours. One of the most amazing things that happens is what?
The veil of the temple
is ripped from top to bottom, meaning that we all now have complete access to God because Jesus has taken away all of the barriers, and all who are in Christ now have access to the throne room of God. So you see, what this period of time is, it's kind of like the Ark was a floating prophecy conference. Well, this is a living demonstration of what we call the church age. This is the church age come before the church age. And for a period of a number of years, anybody and everybody has access to the Ark of the Covenant. You can just go up there and you won't die. Now, the other thing that David did, Peter's wonderful little monograph, if you haven't read it, if you I don't know if you sell it here, it's called From Silence to Song. Or isn't that what it's called? Silence to Song. So one of the things, and I never thought of this till I read Peter's little monograph, but and I think you probably all know this. But prior to this time on Mount Zion, worship is essentially silent. I mean, about the only sounds there would be people maybe confessing their sins over an animal. But then what happens is at Mount Zion, David begins this great reformation of worship. And even though he's not allowed to build a temple, why is he not allowed to build a temple? Well, you're right, essentially. David is a man of blood. He's a man of blood. Now, when I saw, how many of you have seen, it's the Mel Gibson movie about the Scotsman, Braveheart. When I saw Braveheart, which is one of the bloodiest movies I've ever seen, I thought to myself, this is what the life of David was like. It was just bloodshed, bloodshed, bloodshed. He is the man who cleared the land. That's what he did, as beginning with Goliath. He is the one who fulfilled it. For the first time, the commandment of Joshua is fulfilled. The land is cleared. There are no more Philistines out there with their sex and death worship. So now the land is cleansed and purified. Now it's possible for this great temple to be built. And the man who builds it, his name is what? Solomon. Now, there are very few words from the Hebrew language. Unlike the Greek language, we have hundreds and hundreds of words in English that come from Greek. Very few from Hebrew. One of the few Hebrew words that we all know is the word shalom. That's what this word is. He is really Shalomon. If a rabbi were here, he'd laugh at my pronunciation, I'm sure, but that's essentially what it is. It means the Prince of Peace. Oh, does that sound familiar? Solomon is the Prince of Peace. Of course, that's who Jesus is. Jesus is everybody all at once. He's David, the great warrior. He's also Solomon, the great Prince of Peace. So he establishes this temple up here later on, but David is the one who begins this whole reformation of worship. So he reorganizes, and you'll find that all the last chapters of 1 Chronicles, this is what it's all about. David fulfills his calling as the king of Israel, and he reorganizes completely the Levites. And in fact, I'm going to open my Bible here. If you have your Bibles, just open to 1 Chronicles. And if you have a study Bible especially, this is where study Bibles are helpful. They sometimes have, they have big titles to things, so you can actually see what's going on very fast. And beginning with about, well, let's see here. Beginning with about the 22nd chapter on to the very end of the book, you have a long story told about all of David's reformation of worship. 23rd chapter, he gives divisions to the Levites. The 24th chapter, the same thing. 25th chapter is all about the musicians that he organizes. 26th chapter, all about the gatekeepers and the treasurers. 27th chapter, there are various military divisions and so on. And the 28th chapter, he gives all these instructions to Solomon. The 29th chapter, he gathers all of the materials for this great temple to be built, which is tons and tons of silver and gold and precious metals. And gets all this ready. So Solomon, he can just step right in and do all of this when the time comes. Now, here's what's interesting. And I told you I was going to give an apologetic for this. Because we look at the Bible, at least people in Boulder. I don't know about Nashville, but they, oh, what a wicked, evil book. It's about genocide. See, one of the really interesting things is almost without exception, when liberals look at the Bible and they are horrified, and then they proclaim, if you will, and we are the ones who have magnificently created a moral world. What you find out when you really look under the surface is all the things they are taking for granted came from the Bible in the first place. So for example, I'll just give you a simple example. What's the law of the rebellious son? Anybody know?
Yeah.
For who?
Yes,
for the son who says he's a glutton and a wine bibber, and he won't obey anything we say. He's a rotten kid. So it says, if this is the case, then the father and the mother to take him to the elders at the gate, and they have the prerogative all the way up to the death. It does not say you have to put this kid to death. Maybe you'll fine him. Maybe you'll, you know, you just all kind, but you can put him to death. So the modern progressive looks at this, oh, what a horrifying book the Bible is. Now, you see what's, you just look one inch below the surface. Does anybody know what the law of paterfamilias is? It was the law of the whole of the ancient world. Paterfamilias comes from Roman law. It means the rule of the father over the family. It means the father owns his family and he can put any of his children to death with no legal consequence. There is only one place in the ancient world where paterfamilias is overturned. Where is that? The law of the rebellious son. What does it say? Does it say the father can put his kid to death anytime he wants? No. It says in the first place the father and the mother. Notice that. Isn't that interesting? And they do not, as a clan or a family, have the power of death over their children. They must take them to the elders, to the state. It's a limitation of the power of the clan. So the liberal comes along and says, oh, we're wonderful liberals. We would never put our children to death. Well, where did that come from? It came from the Bible they despise in the first place. All right, we look at things like genocide and we say, oh, we're so horrified, which we should be. Genocide's a horrible thing. And the modern progressive looks at the Bible and says, well, look at the book of Joshua. It's a shocking book. It's all about genocide. Do you know, if it wasn't for the Bible, we would still all be killing our enemies to the last woman, child, and chicken everywhere in the world. It's the Bible that put an end to it. And who put an end to it? It's right here with Mr. David. Notice, Mr. David. That's his name. Mr. David is the one who put an end to it. Because what you find in David's life, David is the one who is called to clear the land. And if you will, this is jihad. You could call it jihad. The last time that you find jihad in the Bible is in the life of David. I do believe. You don't find it ever after that. Because in David's life, from Zion, and then this is fully implemented under Saul, Solomon, and he builds that temple up there on Mount Moriah. And what happens is that jihad is transferred from being a military concept to being a spiritual concept. And from now on, what we do is spiritual warfare. That is what has taken the place of jihad. What that means is that Islam is essentially a pre-Davidic movement. It's never outgrown jihad. And most of the tribes of the world still have not outgrown jihad. The only places that have outgrown jihad are places that have been dominated by the Bible for 500 or 600 years. So, the progressive looks at the Bible and says, what a shocking, appalling, and horrifying book it is. It's the Bible that put an end to the very thing they're shocked by. See, the progressive, over and over and over, is the inheritor of the very things he despises. It's an odd, odd irony. We turn on the God who has delivered us in the first place. And what will we turn back to? Well, we'll turn back to jihad and genocide. You can bet on it. Okay, so David is the one who actually brings this to pass. And this, by the way, I think is the explanation of that very interesting, what are the great sins of David's life? We all know that Bathsheba's the shocking, big, you know, that's the big one. What other things did he do?
Murders.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's all tied up with Bathsheba, but besides...
The census.
Now, that's an odd thing, isn't it? He takes a census and God says, okay, David, I'm really mad at you. I'm going to, you know, and we're told in Chronicles that you kind of have this picture of the angel of the Lord. He's got this big golf club, and he's going to just use Jerusalem just as his... He's just going to wipe out Jerusalem. And that's only stopped. I mean, what's the meaning of all this? Well, here's what I think the meaning is. David wants to take a census. Why? What's the point of a census? Is it so you can figure out who to give aid to dependent children to? Is that the point? Yeah, that's exactly right. It's for military purposes. You're numbering all of the males who are capable of being soldiers. Now, David, you see, was the great military king. His calling was, in fact, to do away with the Canaanites and the Philistines and their false religion. By this time, he has succeeded. All that's necessary now are police actions. In other words, you have spiritual, you have holy war, where you just wipe everybody out, jihad, if you will, and you have normal war, which is defensive war, it's taking care of things, it's police actions, things you need to do. And what he's finished with this. But you see, all of us, the way we're built is we are familiar with certain things. Well, David's lived his whole life in all this bloodshed and warfare. And now he's used to it. So, well, let's raise an army and go kill some more people. That's what he's used to. And God says, nope, no way. And what is it that finally puts a stop? The angel of the Lord is stopped. What is it that brings a stop to this? Yeah.
Sacrifice on Moriah.
Yeah. He goes to Mount Moriah. He offers a sacrifice. And there are only about three times in the Old Testament what we find is that fire comes down from heaven and consumes that. This is one of those times. And whenever fire comes down from heaven and consumes a sacrifice, that doesn't just happen every other day, you know. This is a really big deal. It's God saying this is a real turning point in all of covenant history. So this fire comes down from heaven, consumes the sacrifice, and this is a big turning point, and this is where the temple of God is going to be built. So this temple is built, and what Peter shows in some detail is all of the language, for example, all this language of sacrifice and so on, is then transformed into the language of worship. And worship becomes the singing of the Psalms. We don't have any Psalms of David prior to... Or I don't even know if we have any Psalms of David when he's actually singing to Saul. They come from later. But these Psalms, David's the author of most of the Psalms, highest percentage of the Psalms of anybody in the Psalter. And these Psalms are, of course, all the foundation of doing spiritual warfare, which you see was all... What did I erase it? This when David cast the demons out of Saul, this is now going to become what the nation of Israel is called to do. The whole of the world is under the control of the principalities and the powers, the demonic powers, Satan himself. And now up on this mountain, the Levites are going to be singing these psalms around the clock at all three watches of the day. And what's going to happen? Just as David plays that lute and the demons have to leave, now this gets magnified enormously. Now what's going to happen is those Levites are up there singing, or everybody's here, the Levites are singing here too, and you can come up and do it yourself. And this, remember, I put that very accurate map up, and where's Israel in relationship to the rest of the world? Right in the middle. There's a good reason for that. What's going to happen now is that the principalities and powers and the demonic satanic powers are going to be, they're going to have to leave. In other words, the purpose of the temple is to bring exorcism to the whole of the earth. The whole of the earth. All right? Now, what happens when the church comes, the reason the church is such a great advance is it's an advance because you get to go back from the temple to Mount Zion. And now, see, every church is actually Mount Zion Baptist Church or Mount Zion Presbyterian Church or Mount Zion Lutheran or whatever church it is. They're all Zions. Because every church is actually a local office of corporate headquarters and you have immediate access to the throne room of God. And we go up there, we come in this throne room, and what do? We worship, we sing, and we do, we're doing spiritual jihad, if you will. We are the ones who are exorcising the world and are doing away with the principalities and powers. We're the ones who are actually bringing binding with chains those who are the great rulers in the heavenly places, who are actually the power behind earthly powers that are tyrannical, ungodly, horrible in every way, shape, and form. It is actually God's people before the presence of God immediately who are the ones doing this. Okay, why don't I stop there? And I don't know if whatever you want to do at this point.
That's fine.
Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you.